Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
That third voice was Sebastian Clovick-Skelton, still the newest reporter at Computer Weekly. Welcome back on the podcast, Seb.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be back again after, you know, a bit of an absence.
Cool. Well, you've been on it before with Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Goodwin, our investigations editor, but this time on your own. And you're standing in for Claire, who can't be with us on this occasion. So big shoes to fill, no pressure. So we're recording this on Friday, the 1st of May, May Day, International Workers' Day. And we've got a bit of a ordinary person against the machine theme going today, as we shall see. But because we've got a new person on the podcast, Seb, at least in terms of it being remote, it's an opportunity to think about, review, chat about our lockdown routines and what we miss, what we don't miss. And we'll start with you, Seb, as our guest. So what's your routine like these days?
I mean, life's gotten a bit slower, I guess. Not complaining about that. You know, I quite like having the Zoom meetings in the morning because it gives a bit of structure to my morning that I didn't even necessarily have before. So I can kind of roll out of bed at 9, kind of put around for half an hour, check my emails, see what's going on in the world on Twitter. Then we got that meeting. Then I'll do a bit of work, have a shower about 11, and then kind of just, you know, get on with my day, work till about 5 or 6. But after that, it's like I try and really like cut it off hard. Because, you know, being at home, same room, day in, day out, it's definitely harder to switch off. But, you know, not complaining too much. I mean, in terms of what I miss, I guess like just the office, it would be nice to go in for just a couple of days, I think. I strangely miss rush hour.
After really?
It's just...
I don't miss commuting.
It's the competition of it that I miss. The dodging elbows and all.
Oh, like getting the seat on the tube, just like... Yeah. Yeah, I guess that gives you a bit of an adrenaline spike, doesn't it? Just like, yeah.
Just after what you learn how to position yourself right to get the good seats that aren't on the edges that you don't have to give up for old or pregnant people.
But no, I get what you mean, like about the office. Like even if there's nothing really going on in the office, there's still things like someone will say something and you're like, did they really say that? Or like something will happen and you're just like, oh my God, they seem inconsequential at the time, but then now you just do for anything like that to happen when you're just working from home and there's like no interaction. It's, all the silly things you miss.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying I want to go back to 5 days a week in the office, but having the option would be nice at this point, I think.
And I think we had a catch up over Zoom a couple of weeks ago and we were sort of saying about how you have to sort of ready yourself to work a bit differently at home. Like in the office, if I'm in the office like a number of days a week, I know like for some reason I get into my head like, oh, if I'm sat at my desk, I find it a lot easier to write long form stuff or features and things like that. And when I'm at home, I find it easier usually under normal conditions to have my work from home days be sort of working on sort of shorter, sharper bits of news and breaking the day up. But now obviously you can't do that because otherwise I'd never ever write any long form stuff. And that would make Brian, who compiles the analysis and stuff for the e-zine, very, very angry. So yeah, it's having to sort of adapt to things like that I just never really noticed before. Just I didn't realize that was my way of working until suddenly it was like, this is the only way you can work now.
Yeah, I think I'm probably not missing long haul flights to San Francisco in particular, not because I've got a secret family there, but the buzz of San Francisco, Silicon Valley and all that. So my routine is I tend to wake up around 5 o'clock, so quite early. But then I just listen to loads of podcasts, especially the FT's daily news briefing, which I find quite useful. And they usually cover off a couple of the stories that we cover, like today they did Amazon's results and the other day it was, I think, Microsoft's. And then the Today program and then... Yeah, up and ready for our daily Zoom meeting. And then I have to meditate.
What, straight after the Zoom call? It's that hard going.
Yeah, I'm quite into it, the old meditation, I have to say.
Is that a new thing since we went into lockdown, or have you always done it?
A year plus, yeah. I mean, it's kind of dumbed down Buddhism, really. You can't interrogate it too closely or be too sceptical about it because you would really get the benefit. You have to just go with the flow. But I usually need it after the Zoom. And Caroline, you're up with a lark, judging by your early morning emails.
I haven't set an alarm since the whole time like lockdown's been going, which has been a bit of an upside. But yeah, on the whole, it's just, oh, well, I'm up, I'll start work then. And then, yeah, work round till 5-ish, maybe. But yeah, so yeah, I'm up early, but then...
You used to say, like, the daily Boris would be your...
My cut-off point.
But he's not been doing it.
Exactly, in my sort of, I don't know, it's some of the guest stars they've had this series just haven't been enough to make me want to watch it. Yeah, I watched yesterday's one, when, you know, Boris's big return. Mainly because there's some talk that, well, he did talk a little bit about lockdown and stuff like that, but there was sort of some chatter online that he might introduce even more stringent lockdown sort of scenarios after his speech earlier in the week. So no, yeah, that's still... I'd say it's still a little bit of a, right, okay, I'm down tools now, the daily briefing's on. But yeah, on the whole, it's, yeah, get up in the morning, water all my plants. I'm getting more and more plants now because the ones I've planted out have started to grow. And then as they get bigger, they need more water. So yeah, go out, tend to the plants, and then sit down, start work, do the Zoom call. And then, I don't know if you're the same. Maybe I need to meditate. As soon as I'm done with the Zoom call, I sort of feel a bit like I don't know what I'm supposed to be working on. I'm like, what was I doing? Like before we had the morning team call, and I needed like a little bit of time to sort of get back to work, basically. But yeah, and then it's work right round, and then like Seb said, trying to sort of demarcate sort of your time. So it's like, okay, so I finish work at 5, but I'm still in the same room. How do I turn this into fun time now? So yeah, I've been playing Animal Crossing on my Switch from about 5 o'clock onwards, or watching something on Netflix just to just signal a change of time.
You often have forbidding looking books with you when you come into the office. Have you had a chance to catch up with your massive pile of unread books? Are you computer gaming and watching TV instead?
Oh, it's me. I mean, to be honest, I haven't been reading too much because I find it really difficult. You know, same thing of being in the same room of like when you're looking at a screen all day. Sometimes the last thing you want to do is read an absolutely mammoth book. So I've been slowly trying to get through some stuff, but you know, nothing much. It's more been like Netflix, video games, and trying to pass the evening time more than anything.
I found that I've found the same. I can't read books at the moment, but I was on Twitter the other day and a few people said they found the same thing. There was like, it almost like when lockdown was announced, like, oh well, you know, I'm gonna have all this time now, I'm gonna read through this big pile of books, and no one seems to have the sort of the brain space for that at the minute. Yeah. Or they're just like, why has it not happened? Yeah, I think it's just too much going on.
That exactly happened to me. I mean, I thought, you know, lockdown's come in, I'm going to get all this time to clear that pile of books that I've been meaning to get through, and I've read maybe half of one. So not being fantastic progress.
Yeah.
One of the things that Seb's going to be talking about today is Shoshana Zuboff and her massive tome, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. So top line on the podcast today, I'm going to talk about love, specifically the love.
Sorry, why is that so funny? the podcast's taken a real change in tone today.
Seb, as I said, you've got a couple of segments today, Shoshana Zuboff and...
Yeah, I spoke with Chris Smalls, who was the first Amazon employee who was kind of fired for COVID-related protest strikes. So yeah, I'll be talking about that a bit as well. He had a lot to say.
Caroline, you're going to talk about kind of digital events and...
Yeah, I had my first COVID-induced virtual event this week, and it was a really interesting one. It was chaired by Digital Realty, the co-location data center giants, and it was all about sustainability and work they're doing to make sure their data centers are increasingly green and friendly for the environment. But yeah, just some observations on what they're doing, and also, yeah, what it was like doing my first virtual event.
But I'm going to start with today. With the love bug. So 4th of May, just before this episode of the podcast drops, is the 20th anniversary of the Lovebug computer virus, which was the 4th of May 2000. So in the issue of the CWE zine that's being published on Tuesday the 5th of May, we're running a story about the Filipino man who wrote the Lovebug malware in the first place. This is Onel de Guzman, who is now 44. So he was 24 in 2000, very young man. He was a computer science student in Manila at that time, member of a hacking group called Grammarsoft. And the piece that we're publishing, we've already published it on the site, but it's nicely packaged up for the e-zine, is by Jeff White. Jeff is one of Bill's contacts, Bill Goodwin, our investigations editor. And Jeff is an investigative journalist who's covered technology for the BBC, Channel 4, the Sunday Times, among other places. He's got a book coming out this year, crime.com. But what Jeff White, what he did was he tracked down Mr. de Guzman in Manila, where he now works in a mobile phone repair shop in a shopping mall in Manila. The virus itself, back in the day, it kind of exploited a bit of dodgy code that de Guzman says was in Windows 95. You're probably both too young to remember this bug.
Oddly, I do remember it a little bit. My brother was working as a tech journalist then for Computer Active, the consumer sort of tech title. And yeah, he used to come home sort of talking about it because their audience is kind of, well, not hobbyists, like computer users, but people who want to know how to get the most out of their PC. So they had a lot of sort of warning articles, what to look out for, like how to avoid the next love bug and all that kind of stuff. So I do remember it, yeah.
So victims got an email attachment, which was entitled Love Letter For You. And it would overwrite files, steal passwords. Most malevolently of all, it would send copies of itself to everybody in your Outlook address book. And in a 24-hour period, it infected something like 45 million machines all over the world, causing billions of pounds in damage. So it was quite a bad effects piece of malware. Then why did he do this? Well, he says now he did it to get free access to the internet by stealing passwords, because the internet was kind of relatively more closed then, I guess. However, what he did do was he had that kind of fatal auto-spreading feature to the malware that he'd been kind of messing around with. And he did that in spring 2000, and then he released it. But he says now that he didn't anticipate it having doing the damage that it did. We've got a quote in the piece, which Jeff must have got from him, where he says, "I figured out that many people want a boyfriend. They want each other. They want love. So I called it that." And it worked. It worked incredibly well. It went on to inspire the Pet Shop Boys song Email on the release album.
Oh, wow. So quite a legacy.
Yeah. There was another suspect, a guy called Michael Buen. But de Guzman told Jeff that he was the sole author, so he's definitely saying he did this. Now, at the time of this, I was at VNU, so I wasn't really writing about security. I was editor of a magazine, now no longer with us, long departed, called Knowledge Management. But from 2002 to 2007, I specialised in security in a kind of hybrid role for Elsevier, as much of a kind of journals editor as a journalist. And the thing about that kind of role is you get invited to smaller conferences that journalists wouldn't normally be allowed to go to. So I was looking after a bunch of security journals. And so I got to know the security community in the UK and in the US quite well. And I remember being at a conference in Washington, I think in 2004. It was a presentation given by a lady from the Department of Justice, and she had been responsible for taking down and prosecuting the Shadow Crew gang, who were a bunch of carders basically, and kind of put them away. And the thing that I really remember from talking to her was this. So I asked her, I said, "Well, what are these guys like, these cyber criminals?" And she said, I think she said they were quite, and she didn't mean this pejoratively, but quite pathetic. But basically, they were all very young. So they're about like 18, 19. This was an international network, but they had Americans who they put in jail, and they've been chasing various others over the years as well. But she said they were just really young. And she said that invariably, like under interrogation, they would say to the FBI or, you know, whatever law enforcement officer it was, they would always say, I'll come and work for you. Let me off and I'll come work for the FBI. And she said, you know, we don't need them. We've got plenty of skills. We've got plenty of resources. And that's what they would typically say is, look, we don't need you. And you're going to jail. Or you can be an informer. And actually some of them became informers and things like that. But it just stuck in my mind because it made me feel quite sorry for these young guys, 18, 19, maybe first year at university, pre-university. They'd somehow or other got caught up in this organized crime activity. And although they were organized, it always seemed to me that it wasn't really organized crime in the way that we know it, Caroline, from Line of Duty and things like that.
Like the real McCoy.
the real thing. But I did, you know, and it just kind of reminded me of this guy who's, 24 at the time. What's he doing now? He's working in a mobile phone repair shop.
Yeah. Because, as you were telling the story, I was like, I wonder what he got out of it. And it was just, I just wanted some free internet access. It's like, oh, wow. Does it say anything in, because I haven't read the story. Does it say anything in there? Like, was he surprised by the impact that it had or anything? Or
he says no, he was completely shocked by the impact that it had. He sent it to somebody in Singapore and he went out for the night. And he came back and his mother was saying, you know, they're looking for a hacker. And pretty soon they caught up with him. I mean, the FBI tracked him down pretty fast. But he was never prosecuted because there was nothing to prosecute him for in the Philippines. So in a sense, he got, you know, he got away with it.
Yeah.
And did wreak a tremendous amount of damage. Back in 2000, at the time of the love bug, surveillance capitalism was a glint in the eye of Mark Zuckerberg and the Google boys, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. Seb, you've interviewed this celebrity author, Shoshana Zuboff. Tell us all about that.
So I spoke to her, took a couple of weeks to set up the interview, but I spoke to her last Friday for about, it's quite long, hour and a half, hour three quarters.
Wow.
Which gave me a mammoth amount of transcription to do. But it was basically, you know, a look at surveillance capitalism in kind of the age of COVID-19. To see how those dynamics have changed and kind of how the pandemic will impact kind of the practice of surveillance capitalism, essentially. So, you know, I'm still in the process of writing this up. I think it'll probably come out at some point next week. But I mean, what might be helpful for people to get an idea in their minds and how the conversation went with Shoshana, who, by the way, is a very lovely person. It helps to understand, first of all, kind of how it came about a little bit. And then that makes a lot of the parallels much clearer. So in terms of what it is, I'll try to explain very quickly because, you know, she set this out in a 500-page book. so I'm probably going to butcher some of it, but like as a rough thing so people listening have an idea. Surveillance capitalism is essentially like an economic logic that, like earlier forms of capitalism, evolved by taking something that was previously outside the market into the market. So in her book, she argues that under industrial capitalism, that claims nature, you know, forests, that sort of thing, for the forces of production, whereas now surveillance capitalism has claimed private human experience. And so essentially all of that private human experience is contained in the data that we feed into surveillance capitalist services, so Google, Facebook, all these things. And then that data is then repackaged in what Zuboff calls prediction products, which are then sold in quote unquote behavioral futures markets. So, you know, there's that common thing of like, well, if you don't pay for Facebook, you're the product. But she kind of says, we aren't the product, we're the raw material for product, and that product is about us, but it's not for us. So essentially these kind of behavioral products, which are based on kind of data that has like really rich predictive signals, that's sold between businesses. So essentially it's kind of, you know, Google selling that to its business customers who have an interest in knowing how you're going to act, essentially. And I guess the so what of it all, because I hear all the time, it's like, well, it's just advertising, like, who cares? And in our conversation, she made the point that, you know, this commodification of human behavior is kind of being done through a quote unquote one-way mirror. So the fact that, you know, we're all talking about consent now, ratchet it back to when it was all developing, no one consented to this in the first place, like, at all. Like, no one knew that this was the practice that was happening. You know, maybe a few people did in certain spaces, but it wasn't, like, widely, like, public knowledge like it is now. So it's kind of going back to that idea of, there's a geographer called David Harvey, who has this idea of accumulation by dispossession, which basically means, you know, new resources are brought into the market at low to no cost, usually, you know, by claiming public land and wealth. But Zuboff kind of reframes that as, you know, that human experience has been claimed at no to low cost, which is then being used to kind of build a billion-dollar empire. So that's kind of the so what of it all. And I guess in terms of the COVID situation, you know, there were certain historical conditions that allowed surveillance capitalism to come, evolve, emerge, develop. So, you know, in April 2000, you got the dot-com bubble bursts. So everyone in Silicon Valley is just panicking, state of emergency. Investors are pulling out money. So Google, who have, you know, previously said, we're not using an advertising-funded search engine. There's a pretty famous thing they released on it a couple of years before that. But yeah, basically Google, in this kind of high-pressure situation, needed to make money. And it realized that all of a sudden, like, it had all this data that had all this kind of behavioral knowledge in there that it could use to, you know, repurpose that data instead of just improving its search results. And then at the same time, a year later, you have 9/11. So all of a sudden, elected officials who had actually previously been starting to talk about, you know, this was an emerging internet sector, people were actually talking about regulating it at the time, like in the Federal Trade Commission in the US, the FTC. And then 9/11 hit, and what they wanted was kind of quote-unquote total information awareness. So you can see why they'd suddenly become very interested in the capabilities of companies like Google, even though they're still in those kind of early stages. So then kind of understanding those kind of basic foundations, we then kind of went on to talk about, well, what does this current pandemic, what does this current situation mean? And, you know, it was quite... there's a lot of parallels to be drawn in that. She described it as a boondoggle for surveillance capitalists, which is a term I had never, ever heard of. So I actually had to interrupt her and ask her to explain it. Because it's just, yeah, you know, it's an explosive opportunity that's like aligned with your interests and kind of falls into your lap, basically. So it's like, I guess, the most fortuitous possible situation you could imagine. But that's what she said, you know, the pandemic represents for the surveillance capitalists. So, you know, we're all spending more time online during lockdown. Companies like Google and Apple are kind of in the process of expanding their digital supply chains into the health sector. This presents an opportunity for them to really institutionalize those supply chains, was what Zuboff was kind of telling to me. She pointed out, and it was something that me and Bill covered a bit in our Facebook stuff last year, was that, you know, if we bring in these private companies to do this stuff, you know, there's been like Google and Apple with the contact tracing, for example, there's no guarantee that they won't then commercialize it later on, like Facebook did with all the WhatsApp stuff. They said, yeah, we're keeping this data separate, we're not going to use it. And then a couple of years later, they turned around and said, yeah, we're going to start using these.
I suppose they could say, well, you know, we've given you all this help during the pandemic, so take it easy.
Yeah, the government itself is going to these private companies to ask them for their data, which I think goes a long way to show the asymmetries of kind of knowledge that I guess that have developed in the 20 years since this all kind of started developing. You know, the fact that the government is running to these private companies to ask them for their data. You know, all these private tech companies were invited to Downing Street in mid-March, researchers, I think the government must have invited them, they were asking those companies to share their data with them as well. And there's lots of examples as well of how this, how states are starting to use these kind of powers as well. One of the things she mentioned was it's much easier to not do something, not push it through, than it is to do something and take it back. And one of the things she told me in the interview was, you know, there are certain elements of the Patriot Act, which I don't know if you guys are aware of, but that after, you know, 9/11, that was the big thing that came in that allowed the intelligence community and security apparatus to like massively expand. Yeah. But part of that was repealed. I can't remember off the top of my head, but part of that was just repealed earlier this year. So it's taken, and, you know, a lot of privacy campaigners are saying it's not going far enough in terms of the repeal. So it's taken 20 years for that legislation to kind of go back on itself. So, you know, if certain things are put in now, how long will it be before it then takes another 10, 15 years for them to be reversed in terms of kind of state surveillance capabilities? I guess the whole point is that, you know, like when it surveillance capitalism first emerged around the dot-com bubble and 9/11, I think Zuboff sees it, this pandemic, as a real kind of consolidation. It's gotten this far and now they're going to go even further. Mm. Was kind of the long and short of it, essentially.
That's very, really interesting, because I mean, she does have a very high profile in that book. Has been widely praised and stuff, and it's part of the tech lash, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's part of what she says as well. She admits that. She was like, she said, the fact me and you are sat here having this conversation shows a sea change in the past 5 to 10 years towards these companies.
But it's interesting that, you know, you've got her now talking about the pandemic, and, you know, that could be a similar kind of catalyzing event. Same way as you described the dot-com kind of bubble and and 9/11, because, yeah, I mean, that's really good. It kind of moving the conversation on a bit.
Whilst this is a kind of, it can act as a catalyst, she was very firm in saying that it's not inevitable. You know, there's nothing inevitable in how it's gonna develop. I mean, part of the problem is we don't have, what she was saying, you know, the institutional frameworks to deal with this at the moment, which puts us in a bit of a scary situation. But she seemed pretty optimistic. She said this third decade, the 2020s, is where it's kind of make or break, where we need to develop the, you know, new forms of collective action, new kind of social movements to deal with this stuff. Because personally, I'm not very optimistic that a legislative regulatory route will work, just because of that parallel between, you know, the state's interest in it and the private company's interest in it. They both want those capabilities. So why would they regulate it out of existence? I just don't see it happening like that. But, you know, she's much more keen on those kind of legislative routes and getting those frameworks in place. But yeah, she definitely said, you know, now is the time. This is the time to be building these social movements and new forms of collective action to deal with this. So, you know, as much as she was like, we should be frightened, she was optimistic in saying that, like, it's not inevitable and, you know, people can get together to do something about this. Again, you know, looking at how much it's already changed in the last 5 years, how much it could potentially move forward in the next 5.
The current health crisis could be a catalyst, as she suggests, but for sure it's made the world that we operate in even more virtual, maybe temporarily, maybe for longer. But Caroline, you've got some observations about this kind of more virtualization, as it were, not in the computing sense, but in the digital world sense, from your beat, haven't you? I mean, you attended one of those virtual events this week.
Yeah, it was my first virtual event since basically the whole world started cancelling IT conferences and saying, right, okay, you don't need to come to this conference centre now, you just need this Zoom login code and you can watch the keynote. It was with Digital Realty, who are, for the uninitiated, they're one of the largest data centre co-location providers in the world. And yeah, thanks to its appetite for acquisitions, it doesn't look like its share of the market is going to be getting any smaller anytime soon. But the problem, particularly in the data center world, is if the bigger the company and the more high profile you are, the more likely it is that your company's operations are going to get sort of singled out for scrutiny in any discussion about sustainability. It's such a kind of secret society. You know, these companies, they usually operate under the radar. They don't want people to know where the facilities are. So if you've got one who's so big, you know, anything they do, you know, raise their head up is, you know, oh, you know, I've heard about data centers. I've heard they eat a lot of energy. What's your one like? They always come up for, that's a bit more scrutiny. And in Digital Realty's case, they've got 267 data centers around the world. Their energy usage habits, their sustainability track record is going to be something people, you know, will put under a magnifying glass. But, so having that many data centers means your energy costs are going to be extortionate. So it makes sort of commercial sense for a company like that to invest in energy efficiency programs, which are often tied into sustainability initiatives as well. So so this week the event I went to was a roundtable they put on talking about sustainability and what everything that sort of Digital Realty is doing, sort of make sure that their facilities, their 267 facilities, are as green and environmentally friendly as possible. So we heard a little bit about sort of all the money they've spent on energy conservation and making sure all their facilities, or as many of their facilities as possible, run on renewable power, and how they're incorporating environmentally friendly elements into the designs of their buildings as well. This event, though, it was designed to announce the fact that they want to make a commitment, decouple the growth of its business and the demand for data center capacity from its carbon footprint. And so the reason for that is, they said, particularly around COVID, they've seen a massive spike in demand for services hosted within their data centers. Their energy use is going right up. So they've decided that we need to do more to make sure that as the amount of energy used to power the data centers goes up, they are working in a sustainable way. So this virtual roundtable I went to, it's a bit of a scene setter really, but yeah, they basically said that they're working with this organization they're backed by United Nations. This organization, it's called the Science Based Targets Initiative, and they've basically said, oh, we're going to work with them to set new targets around our carbon emissions by the year 2030. So your next question is, so what are the targets like? And they're like, no, we're going to set the targets. Oh, okay. So, okay, well, I'll catch up with you in 2030 then, and how that's all going.
I mean, the thing that's frustrating there is, don't we already know the targets? Like what we need to do?
Yeah.
So surely a target shouldn't be too difficult to figure out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd not heard of the Science Based Targets Initiative before. But apparently there's 873 other organisations around the world who are working with this organisation to set their own carbon emissions lowering targets and stuff like that. And Digital Realty are the first data centre organisation to sign up to it. So with anything like these things, now they've set that, like, oh, we're going to set some targets. People like me have to be on their backs and be like, okay, where's the targets? When are you going to announce the targets? What are those targets? Have you achieved those targets? So that'll be my job for the next few weeks. Yeah, so what was quite interesting during the roundtable is, you know, the impact they said that COVID-19 is having on the company's focus on sustainability. Like I said, there's more people using data centres. Energy use within data centres is going up. So they've sort of said, oh, so we're going to seize on this to concentrate on sustainability even more. And you kind of think around sustainability and green targets and stuff like that, with everything else that's going on in the world, it'd be quite easy for companies almost to put that kind of stuff on the back burner because they've got other priorities, you know, going on. But like I say, it's almost, you know, you could almost forgive them for doing that. So yeah, so it's quite interesting that they said, oh, no, we're doubling down on sustainability at a time when really the business priorities could be focused elsewhere. But yeah, some of the observations they shared during this event about how, yeah, the business of selling data center space is changing because of COVID and some of the limitations, particularly around social distancing, like that's putting on how they do business, was quite interesting. So they were saying that, I know this, I've been on so many data center tours in my life, but the data center tour is like an important tool in selling data centers to people. You get people flying in, from like particularly in America, they'll fly in from different states and stuff like that to go on a walking tour around a facility and have someone demonstrate that, oh, look, these are the security measures we have in place. This is the cooling systems we have. And it's like, it is a one long sales pitch. But they were saying, oh, we can't do that now. Social distancing rules being what they are, the limitations on people flying across country to come and do something like this. means they've had to do virtual tours instead. And they were saying, actually, it's working out really well. You think from like a productivity point of view, an efficiency point of view, it's like you fly out to come and do a data center tour, and you've lost like maybe half a day or a good chunk out of your working day to basically do a 45-minute walk around a data center. Whereas you can do these virtual tours now, and you basically, you know, you can do whatever you're doing and then just tune in and have someone else walk you around and like, oh, can you show me this? I don't know exactly how they work, but this is how I'm imagining they would work. Someone walk you around, so, you know, what are your priorities? What do you want to know? And they would show you and answer your questions as they walk you through it. So they were saying they're becoming increasingly popular because of COVID. But then you also just think, why is that not the norm? Like, you know, it's so easy to do. Why don't people do this? The company's point of view, it must be a lot easier to squeeze in more virtual tours during a day than it is to physically welcome everyone on site, do all the meet and greet, make some small talk. Oh, should we do the data center tour now? Like, yeah, let's do that. And saying that, I was thinking from a virtual events side of things, like usually round tables, for example, are something you have to schlep across London to go to, and you lose, you know, you get tube delays, you get all this stuff that just means that you end up leaving a lot earlier than you need to make sure you get there on time. Or earlier in the week for this roundtable, I was busy doing other stuff, and then I was like, got a diary invite. Like, oh, I need to be logged into this now, and it's just saved so much time. A few weeks ago, when we talked about this on the podcast, I was a little bit like, oh god, everything's gone virtual. I can't be bothered with that. But actually, I think I'm converted. I think it's the future. I can do all this from my sofa, and I think it might change my life. Virtual events. I don't know. This is only my first one. We're tuning again in a couple of weeks when I've done loads of them. I'm like, oh my god, no more virtual events. I want to go to a conference centre. I want to drink terrible coffee.
I'm just thinking there must be a big contrast between, you know, a data centre and an Amazon warehouse.
That was a beautiful segue.
Was it?
Seb, you've got an Amazon story focused on one particular individual. Tell us all about Mr. Christian Smalls.
Basically, he was the first person fired by Amazon following a COVID-related walkout protest strike. There's been a wave of strikes at Amazon, although Amazon would probably contest their characterization as a wave. But a wave of strikes across Europe and the US over kind of unsafe working conditions, you know, lack of social distancing, a lack of, you know, social distancing being practical in these warehouses, no gloves, no hand sanitizer, these sorts of things. And as well, just keeping warehouses open after there's been confirmed or suspected cases. So this kind of started in Europe, in Spain and Italy, which at the time were kind of, at that time, they were probably the most hard hit in Europe. So people started walking out of warehouses there because Amazon didn't shut it. And then, so kind of by the end, that was mid-March, end of March, you have the first US-based strikes. So you had one at the JFK 8 warehouse in Staten Island, which for any hip-hop heads is the home of the Wu-Tang Clan. And then you also had a separate one at a delivery station in Chicago. And basically, yeah, so I spoke to Smalls on Monday, and we're going to publish that conversation today on, you know, International Workers' Day, which is quite appropriate. But I kind of spoke to him about this episode of him getting fired, because basically, you know, somewhat unsurprisingly, Smalls and Amazon have quite different versions of events. So I'll just break down some of that, I guess. Like, for example, the actual protest itself, Amazon says it was only like 15 protesters there, whereas Smalls claims there was at least 50 to 60. They also claim that he was fired for not organising the protest, but for violating social distancing guidelines. But there is seems to be some confusion as to when those guidelines were actually introduced. You know, Smalls himself has said they weren't introduced until April, until after he was already fired. But apparently they were introduced sometime in March. So there's a bit of confusion around there. Amazon also says Smalls was told to quarantine, which he confirmed. But he said that he was not told that coming back would end up with him being just straight up fired. And he noted that no other employees, including the guy that he car shares to work with every day, so no other employees were asked to quarantine, which made him kind of suspect that Amazon had taken note of his organizing efforts, because he was one of the people who, before the strike at the end of March, he was really kind of pushing for things to be shut down, closed, for people to be sent home. He himself, as a kind of a process assistant, sent someone home himself. I wrote a story on Whole Foods using maps to track unionization efforts, and in a small part of that, it mentioned Christian Smalls, where I said he was an assistant manager, as he had in his, he published an open letter in The Guardian, and that's what he said there. But Amazon said he's not an assistant manager and doesn't manage staff, but he's a process assistant, and on Amazon's own job application forms, it says that part of the role is to manage other staff and step in for the manager, the area manager when they're away, which, you know, in spirit, he's kind of an assistant manager.
Mm. I think that's a really interesting bit, because there's how many times in life, or do we know of examples of people who are doing a job that they haven't formally been given, like a job exactly. Title that necessarily means that that's your responsibility. So yeah, that does seem a little bit, okay.
Yeah, and even as a process assistant, you know, he organized, he supervised pickers, who are the people that, you know, take stuff off the shelf, scan it on the conveyor belt, you know, a team of like 60 to 100 of them. It is not right to characterize it as he didn't, maybe he wasn't an quote unquote assistant manager, but he did manage staff that weren't himself. So that's a pretty big distinction, I think. But, you know, he had some pretty strong words about all of this. He clearly wasn't happy, but he definitely doesn't seem to have been deterred in any way. You know, when I spoke to him, he was saying he's already in touch with warehouse workers, you know, across the US, some in Europe as well, as part of organizing the May Day actions that are going to be happening today. And he's kind of wants them to be, you know, every week people just walk out of work, which if it keeps going that way, it could get there, but we'll see. But he was also, you know, very keen to emphasize, you know, he's just the first in a line of people now as well that have been fired for protest, although Amazon obviously cites various reasons for that, saying that they violated this or that guideline or this internal policy. But, you know, I think there's a pattern of behavior here, because I mentioned it in the story I've written up, but Vice News uncovered memos from an Amazon meeting, you know, of all the top attorneys and top execs at the company, including Bezos. But there was a memo written by, I think he was their general counsel. Yeah, their general counsel. A memo saying how they were going to try and discredit Smalls and use him to discredit the wider movement of workers organizing. And then separately, there was that Whole Foods story about them using the heat maps to track unionization efforts. So there's a definite pattern of behavior here. So it's like they're definitely anti-union. And, you know, even, you know, it's garnered some pretty big attention. So the New York, State of New York, the general attorney's office, the general attorney, Letitia James, says Amazon may have violated federal safety standards for providing inadequate protections to warehouse workers, as well as state whistleblower laws. By taking action against Smalls. So that's some pretty serious stuff happening there. So we'll see how Amazon fares with all that. But, you know, I think the big takeaway is that despite Smalls being fired, and whether you believe Amazon or Smalls, they're going to be taking action. Lots of employees are going to be taking action, and I don't think it's necessarily going to abate anytime soon. So I know in the financial results, Bezos pledged all of Q2's profits to coronavirus stuff, which is, I think, $4 billion, which is a lot, which, you know, good on him, I guess. But I think most people are just, you know, their issue seems to be action wasn't taken soon enough. And because of that, lives have been put at risk. And then obviously on top of that, a lot of them are very annoyed about the firings as well, because there's been at least 4 since the pandemic started, of various employees complaining, speaking out.
Yeah, because there was a story, wasn't there? I think I can't remember when it was. It was either start of this year or end of last year that there was sort of quietly a change in sort of the comms policy at Amazon, that staff weren't allowed to speak out about things that the company's doing. And you're kind of like, well, why not if they're unhappy about it? And yeah, we've covered it a few times on the podcast. They are, you know, the staff are at the coalface of this. They aren't shy about speaking up when they're not happy with either the company's track record on climate change or who it is they're selling their technologies to. And yeah, so it's like, well, why would you want to silence staff? Shouldn't you be taking that feedback to make yourselves a better company, but also one that hopefully, you know, people want to work there? I think, you know, that being valued by your employer and your opinions is, you know, an important part of people wanting to work somewhere.
I mean, I think it's just a deeply held attitude at the company, to be honest. Because I mean, in that Whole Foods unionization tracking story I wrote up, you know, the statement from Whole Foods, which is, you know, fully owned by Amazon, they said our employees prefer a direct relationship with the company rather than through a union, which is, that's a big assumption to make when this many employees are trying to unionize and protest and take action. I'm not sure that's exactly true.
It does stand out a bit, Seb, in that kind of world of surveillance capitalism that you were talking about, because compared to Apple or Caroline, you would know more about this, much more about this than I do, Google or Facebook or whatever, it employs a lot of people, and it employs a lot of people of different types, and employs effectively a lot of manual workers in a way which, say, Apple doesn't. I mean, it kind of outsources its production to China and all the rest of it. So it is. So therefore, it has the potential for some of these problems to do with staff.
I mean, I think that's, you know, when you're talking about going back to, you know, how to resist surveillance capitalism in a way, it's, you know, those surveillance capitalist business models, those surveillance capitalist businesses, they still rely on kind of quote unquote traditional capitalism, right? It still needs, you know, everyone that advertises with Facebook or Google and buys their behavioral products, they require labor. They require people's labor. Even Amazon, who's not necessarily a pure surveillance capitalist, because it's got this kind of traditional labor element. You know, I guess the labor element is where you focus your attention if you want to kind of undermine them, which is what people are doing.
But it surveys our behavior very much as buyers and recommends lots of things that we didn't.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they've even put it into their own company, right? In terms of that model of constantly tracking how much employees are doing.
Yes.
You know, there's always the stuff about, you know, how many bathroom breaks have Amazon employees. That's the one that always pops up and things like that. And it's like all these workers complaining of basically being automated, because they've got so much stuff around them, surveilling them and telling them that they're behind schedule and stuff. So it's like, I do think that even that, you know, that surveillance capitalist model has infiltrated their kind of internal, I get just the internal workplace and the dynamics of how it's run as well.
As you were saying, Seb, this story will probably be published today, 1st of May, May Day, the International Workers Day. This coming Monday, by the time the podcast is published, that will be therefore in the past. But that would normally have been the traditional May Day bank holiday. We're getting a holiday next Friday instead for VE Day, for Victory in Europe Day. We're going to be taking a break from podcasting next week. Sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. So on this occasion, it just remains for me to say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much indeed to Seb, our guest today. Thank you very much, Seb.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you very much to you for listening. Again, stay safe and take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.